This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome back to Science with Dr. Carl. And no matter where you're listening from, I wanted to let you know that we are now uploading these episodes to Triple J's YouTube channel. So if YouTube is your preferred podcast listening platform, we are there. You can check out our latest episode. Feel free to leave us a comment, fang us a like, keep us in your feed, and you can hear more episodes very soon. Let's get into this one because we chat about baked beans. They make you fart, but why? Losing muscle tone seemingly after a few days when it takes months to build up, and the shake after a really good stretch. I'm Lucy Smith. Let's do it. It might feel like a Friday to you, and people kind of naturally sometimes feel before a long weekend that maybe they are on a Friday instead of a Thursday. But this year, Easter feels particularly early, and there's a reason for that.
There is, because of the way that they defined Easter to happen. So the way it goes is astronomy. So it turns out that the early Christian church was big on astronomy because for some reason they chose Easter taking over a pagan feast, and they gave it a weird date, which wasn't always the same date each year. So it's a three-part process. Here it goes. Number one, you wait for the equinox, and that's when there's equal numbers of hours of day and night. And this year, it was March 20 at on the east coast of Australia in Sydney, 2:06 p.m. on Wednesday, March 20. Okay, and so there's a line between day and night, if you look at the Earth from outside, and at that exact moment, that line separating day from night, if you're looking from space, kissed the North and South Pole exactly at Sydney time, 2:06 p.m. on March 20. So that's the equinox. Then, this is the rules of Easter, second step, you wait for the next full moon, which was only a few days later on March 25. And then, third part, you wait for the next Sunday. So it's equinox, full moon Sunday. So we go 20th of March, 25th, 31. That's 11 days. But if you're waiting from the equinox to the next full moon, it might not be just 5 days, it might be 27. Mm. And then if you're waiting for the next Sunday, instead of just a few days, it might be six. And so the maximum number of days is 33 from the equinox to the Easter Sunday. This year it was 11. That's why Easter is early. And I'm really enjoying a four-day weekend and a three-day week. I think we should run our society that way. There's enough money to go around for everybody.
Wouldn't it be nice? I've got to say, I am a little... Look, I love the Easter long weekend. I love getting into some chocolatey goodness. I love being with family, et cetera. Mm. But I got to say, I got some things to do in business hours, Dr. Carl.
Oh, what? And is it happening in your holiday
it's
time?
It's happening, and I'm just like, damn, I really could have had this Easter weekend come maybe in April. Do you know what I mean?
The running dog lackeys of the fascist oppressors of the honest working class proletariat who are woke have failed us yet again.
Hey, actually, we were having a conversation on breakfast this morning about what is best to eat Easter chocolate. Is it the hollow egg or a small solid egg? Both are probably the same amount of chocolate when you boil it down. But, Dr. Carl, what's your preference?
I'm going for satisfaction. And it turns out there are six crystalline forms of chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And the chocolate that is, for me, the most delicious is the one that you put on your tongue and it just melts. And as it melts, you can feel a slight cooling. That's latent heat of vaporization or something, one of those latent heats. But the point is that there's six forms of chocolate ranging from the melt on your tongue all the way down to kind of like candle wax.
Mm.
So it all depends on the quality of the chocolate for the eating experience. But on the other hand, as various dietitians have pointed out to us, chocolate is a discretionary food. So if you have a little bit, that's fun. And
come on, Carl.
And it's only people under the age of 10 who can eat an infinite amount of chocolate and not suffer.
That's true. Been there. Hey, are we ready to kick
ready
off these
rock,
questions?
Man.
We've got Evelyn in Tasmania. Evelyn, what is your question? This is something you've been thinking about in the library, right?
Yeah.
What's going on? What do you want to put to Carl?
I was wondering what state of matter is fire, because it's not a liquid because it doesn't take the shape of its container, and it's not solid because it's not a solid thing that you can pick up and throw around. And it's not gas because it produces gas and it also needs gas to exist.
That is very deep, and it's good that the way you've thought about it and then gone to the next step, which is what basic mental tools in my mental toolbox can I use? And these mental tools in this particular case happen to be the definitions of a solid and a liquid and a gas. Fire is difficult. Fire is like love and a wave. It exists, it's real, but you can't put it in a bottle and leave it there. It's a dynamic state. So it is a dynamic state that exists only while you have the ingredients, which are gas and heat, and then you get the third thing happening, you get the burning. So the carbon turns into carbon dioxide plus heat. So you're getting burning, you're creating gas. So you start off with gas, and then some of that gas, the oxygen in the atmosphere, that gas reacts. Now, it can't react with a liquid, and it can't react with a solid, because there's not enough room for the individual atoms of oxygen to kiss up against the individuals of carbon. So what you've got to do is apply some heat to the wick, and then the wick carries some sort of hydrocarbon in it, and then that then turns into a gas. And then while it's temporarily a gas, you've triggered it into the state where there's the gas, the carbon acting as a sort of in a gaseous form with various hydrogen atoms, and the oxygen atoms acting as a gas, and the two gases can kiss. So a solid can't burn. A thing has to be in a gaseous state for it to burn. So I don't have a good answer, Dr. Evelyn. What do you reckon? I don't think that's a good answer, but I think it's getting us closer to the truth, and maybe it's something that's not easily defined.
So what is that? It doesn't fit into a state of matter? It can't be a liquid, solid, or a gas classed as anything?
To get the flame... Okay, the actual flame is a gas. Okay, It is definitely gas, because what you've got in there is some of the hydrocarbon in gaseous form, because you've heated up with the ignition thing, or the heat of the reaction. You've got the oxygen as a gas, and you've got the byproducts, which are carbon dioxide. But then, Evelyn, the heat that is produced, that's not a gas, that's energy. That's Evelyn?
What do you reckon, Evelyn?
Getting there?
I've got no idea, what state it would be.
I think it's close.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, but do you reckon a gas is closest?
Probably.
Yeah, if you go hunting, there's about 10 different states of matter, not just the four that we know of, the three that we know of. Of course, plasma, which is what state the sun is in, where the electrons have been ripped off the atoms, that's the most plentiful state of matter in the universe. But then there's other states of matter, such as a Bose-Einstein Einstein condensate. That's another state of matter which doesn't fit into the solid, liquid, or gas. Look it up on Wikipedia and accept my confusion.
We've got Catherine in Melbourne here. Catherine. Now, Catherine, you've been bulking up, babe. What's going on?
Definitely not bulking up. Good morning, Dr. Carl and Dr. Lucy.
Hi.
My question is, why do we lose muscle tone so quickly when we stop exercising, when it takes so long to build it up? Because honestly, that seems really unfair.
Unfair. Okay, we've got to invoke one of the basic laws of the universe, which is the law of maximum inconvenience. So it takes you a long time to build up, but it goes away quickly. There's three sort of, and I'm notice the word sort of, body types. There's the ectomorph. This is not quite right, but it's close enough. There's the ectomorph, your tall, skinny person. There's your endomorph, your shorter, blobbier person. And then there's your mesomorph, the muscly sort of person. And there are some people who can put on muscle really quickly, but they lose it really quickly. The taller, skinnier people, they take longer to put it on, but they hang on to it for longer, and the endomorphs are sort of in between. You lose muscle strength at 30% per day, and you're thinking one-third, but you have to do nothing. You've actually got to lie in bed and do nothing. And to be fed, somebody comes and feeds you. You don't use your hands. And they've done experiments on this in space, mimicking what's happening in space by having people lying in bed. And then urination, they just sort of, somebody helps them with it, and defecation, they help. So if you do absolutely nothing, at the end of a day, you'll have lost 30% of your muscle strength. And then the next day, you lose 30% of that, and so it goes on. So you do lose muscle quickly, but luckily, you're always moving around. With regard to the astronauts in space, even though they spend 1 hour a day exercising, and it's hard because they haven't got the gravity to fight against, so they have big, strong rubber bands, which they have to stand against and push, but they're only doing that for 1 hour a day, and the other 23 hours they're not. If they've been in space for a year, when they come back, they're kind of like well-boiled spaghetti. They've got no structural integrity. They can't stand up. And they sort of carry them into a banana chair. And you'll see them lying there in a banana chair. And that's not because they're lazy. They can't stand up. But very quickly, just by lifting their arm against gravity, they build up strength.
Wow.
So you have been working out, have you, Dr. K?
A little. I'm actually injured at the moment, and that's the frustrating bit because, you do all this work, you get up to it, and then you have to stop and you go, start all over again.
Okay, now is the injury due from working out?
It's structural. So possibly I didn't help it, but there is some issues with my neck and back. So,
Okay, you can get stronger. It's only when you're in your up to your middle, maybe early 20s, that you can push yourself really hard like Arnold Schwarzenegger and get away with it and push yourself into pain and not have injuries. Arnie was lucky because he had a body type and muscle physique that didn't happen to him. But for most people, you need to sort of back off on the ultimate weight and then just go for more reps and do more of those. Mm. However, we have come across a case of a very muscular Russian, marrying a very muscular East German person, and they had a kid who was muscular at the age of 3 as a baby. Instead of being covered with lots of fat, they had muscles showing. And there are a few people who are genetically blessed that way, so when the two of them got together, they got this kid who's got muscles at 3. Most of us are not that lucky.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've got Jason on the Sunshine Coast now. Jason.
Welcome.
What's your question?
Hi, Dr. Carl. Hi, Dr. Lucy.
Dr.
Hi.
Jason.
So my question is, when I've got a room temperature beverage like a can of Coke or something and I pour it into ice, why is it that it bubbles up and fizzes and loses all of the fizz, whereas a cold drink retains that fizz for longer?
There's a thing called Henry's Law, which kind of applies. And what it says, if you sort of push it a bit, is the amount of dissolved gas increases with low temperature and decreases with high temperature. So if you've got water in the tropics and you compare that to seawater, I'm talking seawater, down in the Antarctic there's more oxygen molecules. So what you get in the Antarctic is more biomass per cubic kilometre. You don't get the diversity, like you've got a couple of 100,000 tonnes of krill instead of just this gigantic diversity you have on the Great Barrier Reef. So when you increase the temperature of something, the dissolved gas comes out. The amount of dissolved gas, in the case of champagne, it's 12 grams per 750 mils. It gives a pressure of 6 atmospheres. So if you have a case of champagne and a case of white wine, oh, those glorious days. But if you do, they have the same amount of liquid, but the glass is a lot thicker. The champagne bottle glass has to be thicker to stand the 6 centimetres, the 6 atmospheres of pressure. So in your case, when you warm up the liquid, the bubbles come out. Is that what's happening?
Basically. I'm too impatient to cool my drink in the fridge, so when I pour it over the ice, it just goes flat.
And for those of you who drink tea, you do not, in India and Sri Lanka, boil the tea. You just wait until it begins to make the first noises, because if you let it boil, you drive off the oxygen, which is no longer available to interact with the tea leaves and bring out the delicious flavours. Mm. So don't boil the water for tea. Just close to, but not quite.
So, pouring out fizzy drinks, champagne, making tea, it's all chemistry, Dr. Carl.
There's chemistry and physics and all sorts of stuff.
Hell yeah. We've got Derek in Melbourne here. Derek, you got a question about stretching. Talk us through it.
I do. Thank you, doctors. Long-time listener, first-time caller. When you have a full-body stretch, and at the absolute extreme of that stretch, your body gets a big tremble. And I was wondering what's that all about? Why does that happen?
And Derek, you've noticed it as well in some of our furry friends. Talk me through that.
So when my dog gets up, my greyhound gets up and has a really big stretch doing downward dog, bum in the air and those arms outstretched in front, at the end of that stretch, sort of the deepest pot, he also has that same sort of tremble. And so does the cat when it's sort of doing that same, pushing the arms out, having that big long stretch, and they all just get that, all of us have that little tremble at the end of that stretch.
I always find that the tremble is usually in the leg, and I find that with my dog as well in that final. I like how you call it, yeah, Derek, the peak of the stretch, just that little tremble in the back thigh. What's going on, Carl?
Hang on, my mind has been blown. Are you telling me the dogs do downward dog?
Yes.
Yes.
What? Hang on. That thing they do in yoga, which they call downward dog, dogs do it?
Yeah.
Why wasn't I told?
They almost always do a child's pose as well. So in that kind of way.
But they do a downward dog.
Maybe less of
it. Okay, my mind is gradually twisted into this. Okay, so the way that muscles work is like two bits of barbed wire that are beside each other that are where the barbs can swing. So you have these two bits of barbed wire, ignore the sharpness of it, just go for the fact that they've got these pokey out things. So you've got these two bits of wire with pokey things on them, and then the things bend and they push one wire past the other and they swing out of the way and they grab onto the next bit of barbed wire. And so they sort of ratchet along each other. So if you look up in Wikipedia, muscle and actin and myosin, A-C-T-I-N and M-Y-S-O-N, M-Y-O-S-I-N, these two long fibres, they go through this high-speed pulling and unhooking and then pulling and unhooking. And when you think about how fast a muscle can move, I'm talking Bruce Lee here, it's just amazing how smooth it can be. So I'm guessing the technical term for this is fasciculation, and you would think that when you got really good at it, you wouldn't have this wobbly. So you see people at the gym, and they're just pushing a straight chest press where they're working on a machine, and all they have to do is apply upward force. But then when that same person does a chest press, so they're lying on their back, there's now an arm, a steel bar across their body, and instead of pushing it straight up, where previously it was constrained to only go straight up, it can wobble depending on which way they're doing. And if they lose control, it can actually fall on their belly or their head or something bad. And they tend to get a wobble. And as you do it more and more, you get better. So that's sort of like a fine tuning of your muscle strength. And that's part of the whole bodybuilding thing. When they stand on the stage and they do the poses, and they don't have that little wobble at the end. And there's a huge amount of training to do that, to try and build up that extra bit of muscle strength right at the very maximum extent of the muscles, the actin and myosin pulling on each other. So it just happens because you haven't done enough training, and you'll probably get to it in 30 years. Mm. And then you can go on stage and stretch. There should be a stretch in bed thing. Category of the pumping iron competitions.
I'd be good at that. Derek, does that help?
I think it does. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. Katie in Wodonga saying the yoga term downward dog comes from the pose dogs do when they stretch before getting up or down.
I've never seen a dog do that.
Haven't you?
Yes, I've had dogs. I've had Kelpies and Border Collies. I've never seen them do it. Maybe I wasn't enlightened enough. Maybe they did it and I didn't see them because I had not achieved my current state of wisdom.
We've got Richard in Hobart. Richard? Now, Richard, you're taking us to space. What is your question?
Hey, guys. My question is about the space shuttle's directional change, how that might happen in space. Mm-hmm. How, a jet ski uses, a jet-propelled thing to move through water on water. A plane does the same thing with, pushing its exhaust air on air. And I was just wondering how a rocket... how a rocket would change its direction in a vacuum of space with no kind of gases to kind of push off.
Ah, hang on, with nothing to push against.
Yeah. How do they change direction?
Okay, how does a rocket work in space, comma, with nothing to push against? That's a bit that's the main part. Okay. Yeah. So this is a three-part story. The first part is in the 1920s when the New York Times turns up to see Robert Goddard, G-O-D-D-A-R-D, and he's launching rockets in America, 1910s, 1920s. And then he says, we can go to space. And the New York Times reporter then says, that's ridiculous, and then checks it with a scientist who says, no, you cannot operate a rocket in space because there's nothing to push against. And they're wrong. Back in 1666, Isaac Newton got booted out of London and had to go home because there was a big plague going on that killed maybe 10%, 20% of people that it affected. And while he was there, he came up at his farm with the three laws of motion, which are really simple and really deep. And the third law of motion is for every action there is an opposite and equal reaction. There's no mention of anything to push against. So imagine you're on a lake, and the lake is perfectly flat and frozen with ice. And you're wearing clothes made of Teflon for some unknown reason, and therefore you got no friction. And you cannot stand up. You can't even stand up. And don't know how you got there. You woke up there in the middle of the lake, right? And you want to get off that lake, but you try to push against the ice, and there's no friction. What you do is you take off one shoe, and you throw it as hard as you can, and you will go in the opposite direction. If that shoe is 1/100th of your weight, you will then proceed in the other direction at 1/100th of the velocity of the shoe. It's called momentum, mass times velocity. But the point is, you don't need anything to push against, you just need to push. And this was very, very deep for Newton to realize that you just have to throw something in one direction and you will move in the other direction. And so the New York Times, on the 20th of March 1969, when they landed on the moon, they then on the front pages had, "Man lands on moon." You know, and down in the bottom corner on the front page, there's a little box that says, "Oh, when we said that you got to have something to push against in space back in 1920, we were wrong. We apologize."
Okay.
So don't worry about not getting it, because it took somebody, a genius like Newton, to realize it, and people still find it hard to believe.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Oh.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Thank Lizzie you, in Warrnambool, adding a comment about the shaking after a stretch, mm-hmm. said, "I raise sheep, and when before a lamb is weaned, we can tell if it's getting enough feed from mum by how it reacts after waking up. A stretch, then a body shake after waking equals a full belly."
Oh.
So it's a good sign. We've got Sarah in Camden here.
Dr. Sarah.
Now, Sarah, you're going to have to do your best to describe this sound. Talk us through it. What's your question?
Okay, so morning. So when we make, my son and I worked this out, when we make a coffee and we stir the coffee, and then when you tap on the side or the rim of the coffee cup, you can, as you tap, the sound it makes just gets higher and higher and higher. It doesn't stop. It's like it could keep going. I don't know where it would end until you stop tapping. So the sound that tapping makes just gets higher and higher.
Ah, so the cup, I'm guessing, is a ceramic cup?
Yes.
And the spoon is made of metal, so you've got a good sound. And
yes.
The liquid is water. Is it instant coffee or coffee from
No? No, even just like a coffee from a machine.
So it's coffee from a machine, so it's a liquid coffee. But do you add sugar to it?
No.
Ah, so there's no sugar.
No.
So what are you stirring? The milk? Or honey?
Yeah, just stirring it through.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've written an article about this, so look up ABC Dr. Carl coffee cup sound. And what's due to is that the bubbles are going out of the liquid. So the extreme case is when you use coffee powder, instant coffee, and you have sugar granules, and in between the grains, there's little bits of air, and they come out and they change the speed of sound in the liquid. What you're doing here is you're stirring it and it's hot, and as you're stirring it, more of the molecules of oxygen are coming out of solution. The thing we were talking about earlier, that at a high temperature, there's less oxygen dissolved. So that changes the speed of sound. So the extreme case where you get the best effect is with instant coffee powder and sugar. But in your case, just even stirring it when you've got no obvious little bubbles of oxygen, even just stirring it will drive some of the oxygen molecules that are between the water molecules out, and that will make the sound pitch go higher. This has been a big discussion. I finally got the answer out of a journal called the American Journal of Physics, which is physics for school teachers, because they get the really best questions from the school kids. And so you've got all these, wait for it, Nobel Prize winners writing for this journal for school teachers saying, "Wow, I didn't know that we had to solve it this way. It's really complicated stuff."
All right. Sarah, does that help?
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One of my dad and my brother's bits that they do is that they'll be in the kitchen making a coffee or a tea or, you know, a hot chockey or something, and they'll just hit the side of the glass as they're stirring, and then they'll just wait to see if someone looks up or notices, but it's just this god-awful rattling sound. They do, and they'll just wait to see if anyone will look up.
Are they calling for approval for the fact that their only deal, the only ever food they make is hot liquid with something dissolved in it as opposed to solid food?
I don't know, but they're being annoying is what they're being. They're just trying to get a reaction.
Biggest sin you can do nowadays.
David in Canberra, what's yours?
Hi, thanks Dr. Lucy, Dr. Carl. I'm interested to ask, what warning would humanity get from an extinction-level event that would be caused by volcanoes? And the reason why I ask that is that I follow a reputable YouTube channel which was looking... I'm not sure that I can mention it on the ABC. If I can, just let me know. Anyway, the thesis that they were exploring was new research that suggests that the Deccan traps might have been the cause for the Cretaceous period extinction event that caused the death of the dinosaurs. And just interested that if that were to happen again, what kind of warning might we get?
Okay, so just one question for you first. Were they saying, from my memory, the Deccan Flats involved volcanoes in Decca, in India, putting out something like 1 cubic kilometre of lava per year for the best part of 800,000 years. Is my memory roughly right on what they're saying?
Yeah, that's correct. That for a period of several hundred thousand years, huge amounts of sulfur and volcanic gases were being expelled, and that might have been a contributing factor in the extinction of the dinosaurs.
So with regard to the extinction of the dinosaurs, firstly, we didn't know, and then with Alvarez and co, and a bit of geological information, we'd worked out that a 10-kilometre rock banged into the southern end of the Gulf of Mexico, where it is now, Chicxulub, and that 10-kilometre rock created a hole 30 kilometres deep, that's three times the height of Everest, and 200 kilometres across. And it was liquidy, and it sort of went blubber, 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 and came out fairly flat, and threw out something, it was all calcium sulfate in that area, and threw something like 1 litre of car battery acid per square metre. Now, I used to be a car mechanic, and I don't know if you've ever dealt with the acid, the sulfuric acid in a car battery. What do you do the first time is you get some accidentally on your fingers and you wipe it on your overalls, and half an hour later there's a hole in your overalls.
Wow.
Right? And so 1 litre of this stuff per square metre. So the Deccan Flats are thought to be part of that. So we're talking about volcanic eruptions, and it turns out that there are not just a few supervolcanoes on Earth, like Yellowstone, which if it popped would cause massive destruction to the human race. And I think somewhere in Italy, is that Etna? Is that the one in...
Mm.
Yeah, okay.
That sounds right, yeah.
But there's 200 supervolcano sites. And if we were to have an incoming rock land on a supervolcano site, we'd be looking at the deaths of maybe 90% of the human race. Now, these volcanoes are always tickling away, and in the past they would put out roughly 1% of what we humans put out as greenhouse gases. So people have said it's the other way around, it's 100 times more, they're lying, it's 1%. But in a supervolcano erupting, you're getting so much stuff coming out that it could cause an extinction event. So what's the likelihood of it happening, and can we warn for it? The best thing we have is a variation on GPS called, I think it's called extended GPS, where you really accurately map an area and then you do some surveying on top of the GPS, and you can measure movements of half a millimetre. And so they've been monitoring movements on, the geoscientists, to combine with GPS and space stuff, they've been monitoring movements on volcanoes, and they can see them sort of swelling a little bit on one side and then going down again. Is that what you're asking, how they monitor the volcanoes?
Yeah, and how much warning we might have of something, of a supervolcano becoming active at a level that might threaten life or most life on Earth?
Don't know, because the best one that we had that we didn't have the technology for, and that was Mount St. Helens in, what's that state, top left corner, one past Oregon, anyway, the next state up, past Oregon, maybe, they got Mount... Okay, so Mount St. Helens exploded, and apparently it was bulging a bit with their primitive instruments. If we'd had the technology we had today, we would then know what sort of warning we would have if a volcano were to pop. So the way we're going to find out is, with our instruments that we have in day, a volcano does pop, and then we'll be able to say, okay, this is the sort of warning we'd have. So at the moment, we're still in the dark. We don't have a good warning.
thank you. That's a comprehensive answer, and it doesn't give me any comfort, but you know, it's certainly an answer. Thank you very much, Dr. Carl.
Thanks, David.
Dr. David.
One of my favourite Italian pizza restaurants. The family is Sicilian, and one of their pizzas is called the Mount Etna.
Oh.
And it has lots of chili on it, hot salami. Yeah. They're sticking to a theme is what I'm saying. We've got Jaden in Glen Waverley. Now, Jaden, talk to us. What's your question?
Hi, doctors. Yeah, so been a bit into the beans lately, be it baked beans, camping beans, that sort of stuff. And I was curious, what in the beans obviously makes you fart?
Right. Indigestible protein, sorry, indigestible carbohydrate, comma, that is not really indigestible. So let me run through it. So if you take in a molecule of glucose that's got one carbon atom and then, it's got six carbon atoms, and stuck to that are six effectively molecules of water, H2O times six. And your gut in your small intestine, so it comes down your mouth, esophagus, stomach where it gets mushed around. So for physiology, anatomy, medical people, the stomach is a small organ about the size of a newborn baby's head or smaller. And then it then feeds into the small intestine, and that's where traditionally we thought that foods could be digested. And then there's indigestible carbohydrate that then goes into the large intestine, and we used to think wrongly that it couldn't be digested. It turns out that it can be digested by the bacteria that live in your body. We've talked about the microbiome in the past, and they're our friends and we need them and all that other sort of good stuff. And they can then attack these molecules of sugar. Now, think about cellulose in a tree. When times are bad, people try to eat tree bark. And the general thinking has always been, there's something there, but we don't have the enzymes to break it down. It turns out, if you look at so-called nomadic societies versus urbanized societies, we can break down 5% if you live in a city, but if you live in an urban society, if you live in a nomadic society, you can break down 15%. With just the natural enzymes in your small intestine, you can break down a little bit of it. And then it's the farts. They've got all these glucose molecules shoved together in a way that we normally can't break with our small intestine. We can't break them apart. But the bacteria in our large intestine can. They get the energy out of those molecules of glucose stuck together in a way we can't normally access. They get goodness out of it, and then they make carbon dioxide, and they make other chemicals as well, and it gives us the fart gas. So if you're farting, don't worry about it. It's not you that's farting. It's the bacteria in your gut that are causing it. Is that kind of answering your question?
Yeah, definitely. I'll put my partner at ease, that's for sure.
Hmm?
Beans means farts.
Have you ever heard the rhyme?
That's right.
Baked beans make you fart. The more you fart, the better it feels.
Yo!
We got Jess in Healesville here. Now, Jess, we were talking earlier about the sound that a cup of tea or the glass makes, really, the ceramic cup makes when you're stirring it all together. You have a question about tea. What's going on in your world?
Hi, guys. How are you?
Very well. Thank you, Dr. Jess.
So my question is, if I drink a cup of tea at night before I go to bed, why is it I only drink one cup of tea, but yet I'm up for 3 hours and I pee so much that it's so much more cups of tea that come out than what I consumed?
Okay. So even though you only carry 40 kilograms of water in your body, 40,000 cross the membranes in your water in a 24-hour period, you are a dynamic maelstrom of water activity. Your kidneys are processing a couple of hundred kilograms of blood each day, and they pull out of it about 1,500 grams of salt, which they all put back in except for 80,000th of a gram, which goes in your urine. So on average, you're generating 1 mL of urine per minute. On average, it sort of varies a bit. So even though you haven't actually drunk a whole lot of water, your kidneys are still working. And then what the driving thing seems to be is keeping your salt level always the same. You measure this in a weird unit called a milliosmole, and I think it's 294 milliosmoles from memory. So you will keep on, even though you haven't drunk any water, you'll keep on generating urine to try and keep your salt level at that same 294 milliosmoles, but then when you don't have any more water, you'll stop manufacturing urine or you'll cut it way down. But the point is your kidneys are always working and manufacturing urine. And also you're losing water through your mouth while you're asleep. And if you weigh yourself in the morning, you'll find yourself a few hundred grams lighter, even if you haven't had a wee. So the simple answer is you're a dynamic machine that is always making urine, even if you haven't had any water.
Mm. Or even if you only have one cup of tea.
Even if you have one. Bearing in mind, you're trying to keep it at around 294 milliosmoles, but there's other things to factor in as well.
Jess, this is really why I try and not drink a cuppa before bed.
I know, but it's such a struggle not to.
I know.
And then you get so dry in the night and you want to drink a big jug of water, then you got to go again.
Cuppa in bed and then you knock off. So good. I've got Michaela from Tuggeranong. Now, Michaela, what's your question?
Hi, Dr. Cal. My question is, how did humans split the atom?
You've got that memory of an atom being like a mini solar system with a heavy lumpy thing in the middle and then all electrons around it or in planets, you know, you got that mental image.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
In the middle of the atom, you've got protons and neutrons. In the case of uranium, you have got a vast surplus of neutrons. You've got too many and it's not stable. And it keeps on changing shape and spontaneously the uranium will split into smaller atoms by itself. What was done in 1938 was that they got uranium and they didn't know that this complicated thing was happening, like the nucleus was continually wobbling around and was always splitting anyway. They knew that it was always splitting, but they didn't know the fine details. And they threw neutrons at a nucleus of uranium, expecting to make a heavier element, and instead it split. So adding the extra neutrons made it even more unstable and it split into lighter elements, one of which was barium, which wasn't there when they started. So they knew that there was something weird going on. That's how we did the first splitting of the atom with German scientists in 1938.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michaela. And we've got Xavier in Hobart here. Xavier, you got a question about water, but in a particular state. What's going on?
Hi, team. My question is, if we're using hydrogen as a fuel to run, say, hydrogen-powered vehicles, if we're getting that hydrogen from water, are we not going to use up our water on our planet if we keep burning it?
Because when you burn hydrogen, you burn it with oxygen and you make more water.
Oh, is it the same amount of water as what was used to create that amount of hydrogen and oxygen?
Yeah. So if you get, say, a litre of water and then you apply electricity to it, you break it into a large volume of oxygen and hydrogen, you throw away the oxygen or you freeze it for some other uses or you cool it down, you've then got the hydrogen, you then combine that hydrogen in a car engine, in say a fuel cell, with oxygen, and you make the same amount of water as you started up with. So you use renewable energy to split it, and then you've got it in your car, and then it'll run it on a fuel cell.
Wow, thank you so much.
Oh.
We've got Simon in Brisbane here. Simon, what's your question?
Hi, Dr. Carl, Dr. Lacey. If mammals swallow seawater, it can make us sick or even die. But how come dolphins and whales, how can they eat and swallow food underwater and not become ill?
If you look at a newborn baby, the newborn baby can suck milk and breathe at the same time. So we can't do that as adults. So they've got an adaptation in the throat and esophagus in whales and dolphins so they can stop water from entering their airways while they're swallowing or sucking. Then they do very rapid swallowing. Then they've also got very highly specialised musculature that minimises the amount of water going through and keeps the food going through. Plus they're doing it underwater, so the pressure difference also helps stop the extra water from going down. And they've adopted their feeding behaviour. So they will take in some water, they don't like it, and they get rid of it as fast as they can.
Oh, so it's not just this cycle of water going through.
No, and in fact, originally we all started on the oceans and then we came on the land and then I think about 45 million years ago, around the time that the India started running into Asia and pushing up the Himalayas, then some cows or hippopotamus-type precursors went back into the ocean and became the whales.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Science with Dr. Carl. And a reminder, we are now uploading these episodes to YouTube. So if you want to check us out there, feel free to do so. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan, Max Laverne and Nick Gerber. I'm Lucy Smith. I'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.